Castellanos has it, and the Phillies have the National League Championship. They have beaten the Padres 4-3, and they celebrate on their home turf as the Phillies are the 2022 NL champs.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 620. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. And coming up, we got a special mailbag edition of the podcast. We haven't dipped into the mailbag in quite a little while, so I thought we'd take the opportunity now that the World Series is over, before free agency really starts to get in gear, to answer some questions. And we got a bunch of them through the Twitter machine. Amazing. Twitter is still active. We thought it was all going away the other night. And so we decided to take advantage of the opportunity to use Twitter for however long it might be available to take some questions. So we will spend the majority of the podcast doing that. Joining me, as he always does this time of the week, is my good buddy Justin Clue. Follow him on Twitter at Justin_Clue. You can read him on Baseball Prospectus, hear him on Continued Success and The Dirty Inning. Justin, what's up, pal? Thanksgiving's almost here, buddy.
How about it? How about it? What a organic topic to throw into the mix.
Just occurred to me right now that it was almost Thanksgiving then, and that we could discuss it.
Our famous repartee strikes again.
Totally unplanned.
Looking forward to it. I was promising we'd have a new Dirty Inning this week, and we're not going to. Trev is on the road, so apologies. And apologies to our friend Paul, who keeps asking me what I'm going to make you and Liz do for losing that contest where we assigned point values to team win totals.
Paul was really interesting. And I love Paul to death. He's one of our favorite listeners and most devoted fans. He was really into keeping us on track there.
Yeah. And I was glad
Hats
he did.
Off, Paul. Because, Hats off, because I lost. It was bad.
Yeah, I don't win contests. So that I won is a huge deal. And I did have an idea, but it involved me writing something and I haven't written it yet. So when we're all back on the show at the same time, we'll go down that road. But, also congrats to Liz. She also won. What did she win? Like, somebody was keeping track of our picks.
Her division winners and stuff.
People are going to keep track of the things we say and hold us accountable for them. I don't like this at all.
No, this is things are going in a bad direction. This is not what I wanted at all.
Think about it and make sure things align with previous things I said. I'm not going to do that. So
No, that's bad. Don't make us be consistent, folks. This is not going to go well for us or you. Actually, we're looking out for you, to be honest. But it is Thanksgiving coming up in just a couple of days. We're recording this on Thanksgiving Monday. Justin and I were talking just before we got started about Thanksgiving plans. Justin's been brining a turkey, and my father-in-law is going to be going the smoked turkey direction in a big green egg. I know everybody's probably got their own ways of doing turkey. There is a growing backlash, by the way, Justin, of anti-turkey people out there. Are you aware of this? Have you seen this, like people demeaning turkey as a food choice, especially on something like Thanksgiving? Like, turkey's dry, it doesn't have any flavor, blah blah blah. And I'm not hearing any of that. Like, it's not. You can lose me with the anti-turkey sentiment. Turkey rules, especially on big holidays like this. If you had turkey like once a week, yeah, I get it. Wouldn't be a big deal. But you have turkey like twice a year. It's a fun thing, and people just want to poo-poo on stuff that other people like. So shut up.
Look, if you want to like eat, I know Liz's family does a big Italian dinner on Thanksgiving. I think that sounds delicious. I mean, you want to eat
it's controversial
something,
though. It's controversial.
Other than a turkey, if you want to eat an olive loaf on Thanksgiving, like go for it, man. I don't care. But then it's that people have to turn around and be like, oh, the thing I do instead of the normal thing didn't get enough attention. Well, then I need to turn around and make sure you know that the thing I'm not doing is stupid. And so they go on this, like, I have a bunch of feelings that are anti-turkey on Thanksgiving. Like, why do you have those feelings? That's stupid. You have that many feelings. This is a novelty. It is, yeah. I mean, a lot of people are just doing it because it's traditional. I like turkey. I don't think it has no flavor. Great. I think it's easy to dry out. I think if your turkey's always dry, you suck at cooking it. So that's probably an issue.
That's probably what it is.
But yeah, in general, I'm not going to come down on anybody's eating habits. I have no idea why you would do that except because it's Twitter content. So that's something that I won't miss when Twitter does die, is the people who are like, I'm going to be the main character today. And my topic is turkey on Thanksgiving is bad. Okay, that's great. Let's all spend our afternoons fighting this fight like we're morons.
Yeah, we and sadly sometimes we don't have anything better to do.
Yes, as me, someone who's never gotten into a conversation like that on Twitter, I can speak from my high horse, certainly.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say that
high horse being what my family eats on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you need the high horse. It's where the dark meat is, right. Is best for sure. I think with turkey, you do need to have gravy for it. I always do like a mashed potatoes and gravy and turkey combination. So yeah. I just mix my turkey with that mashed potatoes gravy. And I think at Thanksgiving, gravy goes on everything. Right. I mean, you have a nice thick turkey gravy. It goes on the mashed potatoes. It doesn't go, no sweet potato casserole. It doesn't go on sweet potato casserole. That's because that's, psychotic, but it will go on mashed potatoes. It can go on green beans. It can even get on the cranberries a little bit. That's a very delicious, savory, tart mix there. The turkey gravy should be a little bit on everything on your plate on Thanksgiving, as far as I'm concerned. There's nothing that with the exception of the sweet potato casserole that gravy can't touch.
I mean, good luck stopping it, even if it's not your goal.
That's right.
Like, it's probably going to happen anyway. So the point is to make a gravy that's good enough that it can go with everything, because it's going to get everywhere. It's a liquid. So
now I know there are people, you said Liz has the Italian Thanksgiving, and unfortunately Liz couldn't be with us today to jump. She may jump in at some point during the course of the show. We'll see. But I like the idea of having like an Italian dish to go along with it. My family will typically do, because I do have people in my family who don't like turkey, and so they end up making something else, which is fine. If you don't like turkey and you're willing to cook another entree for yourself to share with everyone else, wonderful, beautiful, no problem with that. I might not eat it. But my sister usually does a baked ziti, and she'll bring that with her. I've seen some people make a lasagna and bring that with them for people who don't like turkey. And I think that's great. I have relatives who think that's a huge no-no, like that Italian food has no business being anywhere near Thanksgiving. And again, I say this is a bit militaristic. Let's all live our lives. But there are people with very strong opinions on this sort of thing. So I don't know.
I'll be honest. An extra plate of Italian food is always welcome at my table. When I was going through my growth spurt and eating everything in sight, I had one of larger appetite. It was this past October, I think. I remember one of the things that happened was my grandparents took me and my cousin, who was my age, on this baseball road trip, and they took us out to Chicago. We saw Cubs games and White Sox games, up to Detroit, saw a Tigers game, over to Pittsburgh, saw the Phillies play the Pirates at PNC. So I saw a lot of ballparks and everything, but they were obviously feeding us this entire time too. And when they came back, they were basically like, oh, Justin ate all the steers in the Midwest, because I was just eating steak nonstop. And I basically got to a point where the pattern emerged that I would eat my food, then I would eat the rest of my cousin's food because he didn't have as much of an appetite. And then I would typically be the only one who got dessert. But at this one restaurant, I mean, it might have even been like Harry Carey's Steakhouse or something. But at this restaurant, it was like customary. They just gave you a plate of spaghetti. So I got to like eat that too. And at that point, I was like, this is awesome. Steak, potatoes, whatever stupid greens were there. And then like a plate of spaghetti and the rest of my cousin's food and then dessert. I was like, yeah, this is great. See, this restaurant gets it. Surprise pasta? Come on. That's getting ambushed by spaghetti? That's brilliant.
That is brilliant. That's fantastic. I'm jealous now. That's a dining experience. Obviously, you don't forget.
Doctor's given me 2 years, but
but it was worth it.
Absolutely,
totally worth it. So last thing on Thanksgiving is sides, right? I mean, the sides are as important, if not more important, than the turkey itself. Because if you just have turkey and you don't have anything else, it's why did you show up? So I mean, I myself am. I gotta have mashed potatoes to go with the turkey. I think mashed potatoes is vital, and because you got to get gravy on all that stuff. Stuffing the dressing, I don't know how you refer to it, as stuffing or dressing.
Stuffing.
Stuffing. Okay, good. That's how I refer to it as well. My father-in-law loves oyster dressing, oyster stuffing. Have you ever had that before?
I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, little bits of oyster in with the dressing. I really liked it. I've only had it a couple of times, but I really enjoyed it. He loves it. We're not going to have that this year because my sister-in-law is the one who normally makes it, and she's going to be out of town. But I also love to have like little bits of sausage in the stuffing, which is, it's vital for giving it a little bit of extra flavor. You got to have a sweet potato casserole. I think you got to have a green of some kind. So like a green beans. I'll do a Brussels sprout with some bacon on them if you do it right. And that's basically all I really need. I don't think you need a whole lot more.
I just need five dishes, four of them with meat in them, and some mashed potatoes. That's solid. Yeah. No, I'm not going to argue with that. I do hate green beans. That's when I was a kid, I was very adamant about not eating vegetables. I was like, my parents had a really tough time with that. And then I got older and, you know, I would start dating and girls would feed me something. And then it was still, yes, I'm going to eat all of this, obviously. So I started eating a lot more vegetables at that point. And I now eat most of them, but green beans, I'm still not on board. I think it's just a childhood stubbornness thing at this point. I can't even really remember what they taste like, but I don't want them. So green wise, I'm definitely going to go broccoli or Brussels sprouts. I totally agree there. And there will always be a sweet potato casserole at a Thanksgiving I'm at, but I'll tell you what, I'm really not a big sweet potato guy. Like I'll eat it. I don't dislike it, but I'm so much more of a regular mashed potato guy that the sweet potato just seems like a superfluous kind of dessert version of the food I want. So yeah,
it is, but I still got to have it.
Yeah, I understand that. That's fine. Yeah. I think I just got to the sweet potato game pretty later in life as well. That was not super customary in my house growing up. So I just didn't like adjust to that. So I feel like I agree with most of what you're saying. Obviously cranberry sauce, pretty traditional. And then, somebody will bring like mac and cheese or something one year and it's like, all right.
A little bit of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Why not? These are all good things. It doesn't matter if they're like perfect complements of each other.
Exactly.
At all. But yeah, I feel like if you're going, Brussels sprouts and broccoli, I want to make them crispy, maybe throw in some apples if you can get them right.
Okay.
There's a narrow window. Like you can over soften your apples, throw that in there, sliced almonds perhaps. But like you said, obviously bacon is the way to go as well. Yeah. Are you a stuffing in the bird man or is it a separate dish?
It's a separate dish, but I'm not against it. You gotta be real careful with it though, obviously.
Careful. Yeah.
So we normally don't even play around with that.
Yep.
We don't even play around with that at all.
Yep. Same. So that'll be my wife loves stuffing. So she'll be on top of that one. And then I'll probably get some sausage in there as well. So yeah. I'm glad Liz just got here because she'll be able to spice up our incredibly mundane and agreeable opinions that totally align with each other and make this show, you know, listenable and not just the same person repeating themselves.
Yeah. Hi, Liz. Liz joining us now. Liz, we've been talking about Thanksgiving and we were talking about, food and preferences and all that kind of stuff. And Justin was telling me you guys do like an Italian Thanksgiving. So what do you guys, with an Italian Thanksgiving, what do you all do?
Yes, this was how my mom, who's from a big Italian family, my mom and her family used to celebrate Thanksgiving back in the day in Shamokin, PA. We have normal stuff like turkey, but we start the meal with homemade Italian wedding soup. Delicious. Yeah. Then for our middle course, there are little crepes. They're tiny. We fill those with meat and cheese. And smother them with tomato sauce.
Wow.
Homemade tomato sauce. And then we've got turkey, but we don't have like a lot of the traditional like beans and whatever. We have a sweet potato dish that's more brown sugar and nuts than it is sweet potato, which is the only way to eat them. And we do one of my favorite things is a cranberry salad we do. It's like a jello.
Wow.
It's like two packets of cherry and a packet of lemon. You chop up nuts, celery, pineapple. And you put all of it together and it's really good with like a fork full of turkey and gravy together. I do not like stuffing. There is stuffing at the meal. I don't like it.
See, Amy's the same way.
It's wet bread.
That's what she says. Yes, my wife says the same thing, and I disagree wholeheartedly. But that's
suddenly we're all just better than wet bread. We're better than the ducks. Suddenly, yeah. Okay.
Oh yeah. No, tell Amy that I agree with her. She's not insane, and that her and I should talk about it sometime.
Yeah, because
if you also don't like stuffing, you are not alone. Be free to share your opinions and tell all the people from Big Stuffing to stuff it.
Liz, is there an Italian term for a meal where you are just brought a plate of spaghetti that's like maybe you didn't order? It's just kind of like free. It just comes with like the table almost. Is that a term? Is that a thing?
I don't know if it's a term, but I don't know an Italian restaurant that has just brought a plate of spaghetti as part of the pre-meal free bread and butter.
I wonder if I've imagined this.
I wonder if you have. But listen, I wouldn't say no depending on the restaurant.
Or some waitress took a shine to you or something, Justin. Something happened in the back. Like, I don't know what that was.
It happens. I've never. And that's the classic way a server shows their attraction to you, bringing you spaghetti.
That's what I'm just saying. The traditional way people show the spaghetti-based flurry.
And then I have to save just enough of the pasta to shape out my phone number and return the plate to her. It's an Italian love story.
This is
where Italian wedding soup came from.
Yes, that's right.
This is how my grandparents and great-grandparents met.
Yeah, back in the old country, this is how it was done.
This is how the game is played.
Sorry, I'm hearing the Curb Your Enthusiasm theme music in my head right now, by the way, too. All right, well, let's hop into some of the mailbag questions we got here. We got some good Phillies questions for the mailbag, so we'll answer as much of these as we can. We'll start off with Todd at TCNNC. Who asks, obviously other variables were in play. We're going to be talking about the World Series a little bit here. Other variables were in play, like good pitching shuts down good hitting. But batting coach take any blame for the World Series hitting woes? Kevin Long signs a 2-year contract extension to be the team's hitting coach. And I think we all kind of looked at what he did with some of these young guys this year. And with Kyle Schwarber having the best year of his career, Kevin Long, a valuable part of what the Phillies did this season. But the offense did fall off a cliff in the final three games of the season. And I think a lot of people are like me, still trying to figure out exactly just what happened in those last three games. Like, was the Astros pitching really that good? Or did the Phillies bats suddenly go silent? Were they spooked by the no-hitter and kind of lost their confidence? Were they tired? Did they hit a wall? Was it all of those things? Some of those things, none of those things. Everybody's still trying to figure out exactly what went wrong in those last three games. And now we're trying to see whether or not the hitting coach takes any blame for the World Series. And, you know, Liz, I don't personally think he has a whole lot of culpability on a 3-game swing where the hitters suddenly grow cold. But at the same time, you kind of knew what these Astros pitchers were going to do to you. You kind of knew about the invisible of Christian Javier. You knew how hitters struggled against it. You kind of saw Framber Valdez in Game 2 and you get him again in Game 6 and there really wasn't any improvement there. And, you know, so at the end of the day, it's a question that's being asked. What do you think?
You know, a good hitter misses 7 times out of 10. Like, so you got to put this in perspective. It was a very important 3-game swing, but it was just 3 games out of a larger season. And granted, those 3 games matter more than any of the other ones that came before it, but you can't hold him responsible for that. The players are just as responsible if he has any responsibility. You know, baseball is baseball. People hit, people don't hit, life goes on.
I feel like you're digging pretty deep for blame if you're blaming the hitting coach for the World Series. That's more of like a regular season blaming thing. It's like, exactly. We haven't been able to get it together for 3 months. There's a good chance we're not getting it together at all this season, but just to show people we're awake, let's fire the hitting coach. That's how that system works.
Yeah.
And obviously Kevin Long's impact on this offense was registered long before the World Series and was, I would say, probably at least a medium-sized reason they got to the World Series. So you're not what's he going to pull Alec Boehm aside and whisper in his ear during the last 3 games of a World Series to really change things? At that point, you got to just trust what your offense is capable of, what they've learned to do earlier in the year back when losing a game didn't mean as much as losing a World Series game does. And hope that, you know, you hope that they can make the adjustments and that they have the mental approach that's going to be able to turn things around. But at the same time, that's really hard to do. And, you know, that's what the value of having this playoff experience is, I think, for a lot of these guys who were in the postseason for the first time. But at the end of the day, the hitting coach doesn't have a magic spell he's gonna be able to put on these guys. That's not really what he's there to do. And there's only a certain amount that some guys are even going to be able, are even going to listen to him. You know, he's only talking to a certain amount, like number of guys on that roster anyway. So, yeah, no, I don't think you're really going to get a lot of traction trying to blame Kevin Long for the offense shutting down in the World Series.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there's a whole lot there, but, you know, it's everybody's still trying to figure out what went wrong, and nobody seems really to be satisfied with the answer that Liz gave, which is like, yeah, it's three games. The Astros pitchers are really good, and sometimes bats go cold. it's an unsatisfying answer because you want a solution for it. It just might not be a solution. It might just be life, you know?
A thing that happens.
You know?
It's more about what they're able to do with what the hitting coach has already taught them than anything he's going to actually do for them in that moment.
Right. There's not. Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. Next one from Mike H. at Mike H. 483-44551. If you can remember that Twitter handle, good for you. He asks, John, who do you think are the two biggest free agents at shortstop and pitching that the Phillies out the most? I think it was misworded. But he's talking about the two biggest free agents that the Phillies will get in the starting, in the shortstop market, in the starting pitching market. And as I was going through the MLB Trade Rumors top 50 free agents with predictions, looking at some of those number three, number four starters in those tiers, they don't have any of those guys. None of the writers for that site have the Phillies getting any of those guys. I'm talking about like Jose Quintana, Jameson Taillon. What are some of the other guys who are Nathan Eovaldi? They don't even have him re-signing Noah Syndergaard, for crying out loud. Andrew Haney is another one of those guys. Sean Manaea. Taiwan Walker. So I mean, there's some decent names there, guys who could be in the middle of a rotation. And I was kind of surprised that they didn't, that none of them had the Phillies taking any of those guys or signing any of those guys here in the off season. So Justin, I think we all kind of have talked about the shortstops quite a little bit. You really can't go wrong with Trey Turner or Carlos Correa or Xander Bogaerts or Dansby Swanson even. The starting pitching market seems a lot more interesting to me because there's a lot of different possibilities there. Chris Bassett being another one. Do you guys think, Justin, do you think they're going to get one of those guys?
Yeah, I do. I don't think it's going to be anybody. I think it's going to be one of those signings where everybody has their idea and they're going to have enough time to talk themselves into what the best idea is in their heads. And then the Phillies are going to sign somebody who nobody was like talking about. That's the general approach I think they're going to go here, because if they wind up spending the kind of money they're going to spend at shortstop, I think that does lower the odds that they're going to get somebody that somebody on Twitter thinks is a huge difference maker. I mean, I think any one of those guys you said is on the table. I don't know. I'm just leaning in the direction of they want to do a little better than Syndergaard. Not that I really have a ton of complaints about what Syndergaard was able to do with the role he had with the Phillies. They just need, you know, they need another guy who can go 5-6 innings in a playoff game. It wasn't like they had a guy and they just weren't good enough. It was just, they just didn't have a guy for that role. When the Astros were like, all right, next man up, the Phillies were like, and they just kind of had to roll with it. So I think it's going to be hard for me to be underwhelmed by whoever they used to fill that position. And that market hasn't narrowed enough for me to really form an opinion. I did, however, spend a little more time on the shortstop question. I hadn't really thought too hard about it. I know there's just like, you know, three names out there and two of them have been linked to the Phillies. I honestly, at this moment in time, I think I'm leaning more towards the Bogaerts direction. Do you have any idea how staggeringly stable Xander Bogaerts has been?
Yeah.
He has put up the same really good numbers for like 7 years. He just won his fifth Silver Slugger in 7 years.
Oh my God. Wow.
Yeah.
And the Red Sox are just going to let him
go. I mean, good Lord. Even during the pandemic shortened season, he was like, yeah, okay, I can, you know, play in 56 games. And, you know, his like worst season, he hit .273. His like worst non-Silver Slugger season. Meanwhile, Turner, who obviously, you know, I wouldn't be upset to see him signed by the Phillies either. But like, he's a guy who really, he can go into, if I'm valuing Bogaerts for his consistency, Turner can go into these fits where he hits the ball on the ground. And his hitting and speed is way more valuable when he's getting the bat under the ball and putting it in the air and hitting line drives. And just on a lark, I looked at the Fangraphs numbers as far as pitching staffs in the NL East, and the Mets and Braves were like among the middle of the pack at most at allowing the ball to leave the ground. So I don't know. I would be better. I would be certainly happy and more than pleased to see either Turner or Bogarts playing for the Phillies. But yeah, just looking at the numbers and the kind of players they are, it's like, man, it's tough to argue with these Bogarts numbers. He is not a high profile guy who gets a lot of attention or anything, but he's got to be one of the best players in the league. Certainly one of the most consistent ones. Of course, they went that route with McCutchen and Robertson a couple years ago, and consistency went right out the window at a certain point. So I don't know if you can consider that a strength.
It's slightly different, I would say.
Well, he's much younger. He's much younger. And
all these guys are going to be 29 or 30, by the way. I don't know what I'm not really making a point there, but it's just something I noticed. Every key player in the Phillies lineup is going to be 29 or 30 or like turn 30 this year. You know.
We've got like a year left before people are just like, the Phillies roster's getting old, yep. Guys. Shut up. Shut up, all of you.
There's still times. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's not like Verlander, where the first thing I think is his age at this point.
Right.
God, he's older than Liz.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing, too, is like, you know, looking at some of these pitchers, you know, Verlander is a free agent, obviously, and I don't think anybody thinks he's going to the Phillies, but looking at some of the guys that, the MLB trade rumors guys are predicting to go to the Phillies. One of them picked Carlos Rodon to go to the Phillies. Another one of them picked Verlander to go to the Phillies. And I don't, if they're going to go get one of those top shortstops, Liz, that they're going to have to give it, you know, that got a qualifying offer. I don't think they're going to go after a starting pitcher that also has turned down a qualifying offer. You're going to lose a lot of extra draft picks and stuff if you end up doing that. That being said, there's lots of help out there at the two places the Phillies really need it this offseason. What are you feeling in terms of shortstop, starting pitcher? What kind of combo they're looking at? And what kind of combo you'd like to see?
I think as I talked with Justin about last week on Continued Success, I have a hard time choosing between like the two main dudes we're looking at shortstop. I'd be happy with, this is not a Manny Machado, Bryce Harper situation. Because I would genuinely be happy with Bogarts or Turner. Like, I'm a little less into Turner considering Justin is like, he has periods where he just hits the ball to the ground, like another player that we know who's also very streaky and hugely frustrating. Mm-hmm. I'd love to avoid having another guy like that on the roster. But either way, I'm really happy with both. And I'm trying to get a handle on what pitchers are available. But, you know, if they have to choose where the Phillies have to choose where they're going to go big, you know, they're going to if they need to go over the threshold, they will do it. They've done it once. They'll do it again. And as far as qualifying offer, I don't think it's really a team like the Phillies. They're in win now mode. They're no longer fearful. I think they've got draft pick. They've got guys they've drafted they want to hold on to. But I don't think they're going to be as precious with draft picks as they were in the past. Because, you know, they've got a lot of the guys they need right now. I'm not saying they shouldn't worry about it. But when you're in win now mode, what you want is the right guy for the right spot. And you don't want to – DeBrasco's not going to worry about giving up whatever it is he has to give up for a qualifying offer if he gets the guy he wants. None of us will be crying.
So I was going to ask that,
you know,
actually.
6 months from then,
like
if the Phillies, whoever that player is, if they've helped the Phillies get to where they are, none of us will be crying. None of us will be upset. I can't imagine. Like, qualifying offer stuff is stupid. Everyone should just ignore it. Either take the offer or sign the players. Just ignore all the compensation stuff because it's pointless.
Do we feel like, are we just applying the logic that if they get somebody who's the highest priced shortstop, they would go lower on a starting pitcher they also need? Like, who's saying
that's,
that?
That's been my assumption. I think that's been the assumption of most.
I mean, it obviously makes sense, but I'm just saying also isn't there a small crumb of the possibility where they just don't give a crap?
Yeah, anymore? There is. That world totally exists. I mean, it was just, I think the body language and the stuff Dave Dombrowski said at the news conference led me to believe like that they're interested in a starter, but that it's not like a priority. Whereas with the shortstop, it sure sounded like, you know, hey, we know these guys are awesome. And yeah, we're going to be, you know, he didn't come right out and say it, but you know, that might just be my prejudice of what they've done in the past, what historically, how they've approached things like this, and trying to remember that last year they got Nick Castellanos and none of us saw that coming after Kyle Schwarber was signed. And so,
remember that, I've completely forgotten what I was going to say. Damn it. And I interrupted you at everything.
That's all right. I think the number that if I'm thinking about Justin Verlander, he wants like a 3-year, $100 million type deal. He's 40, 3 years and $100 million. That's risky, but a team like the Dodgers would do that. And so if the Phillies want to kind of play in those waters, that might be what we're looking at. And then you're signing a shortstop on top of that. I'm all for it. I'm maybe not there in terms of thinking that it's likely.
Yeah, I think we're just trying to be realistic with what the Phillies might actually do. Yeah. Like there's definitely a chance that they'll go hog wild because they got so close, mm-hmm. you know, less than a month ago. They were right there, you know, and no one wants a replay of the last run where the returns diminish every single time we go.
Yeah.
We didn't even get anything this time. That can't happen. you have to win the big thing before the returns diminish.
Yeah. Totally.
Oh, I remember what I was going to say. Dave Dombrowski, don't trust him. Whatever it is he says, ignore it.
Oh, just yeah, because he's going to lie right
number
now.
Yeah. He's going to lie. He lied to our faces. He's lied to all of us several times.
And that's fine.
And he's really good at it. The man is not a Hall of Fame manager, will be or whatever. He didn't get to where he is by telling reporters the truth and being bad at lying. Right. He is very good at what he does because we all believed him for the most part when he was like, yeah, I'm not really going to evaluate Joe Girardi until, I don't know. And then like a week later, he was gone.
So trust him in the macro sense, not necessarily in the micro sense of this free agency period, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. It's been a long time since I've trusted a baseball executive this much.
It feels weird.
It's very scary.
It feels weird.
It's scary.
Yeah, it doesn't fit. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the mailbag. So everybody stick around. We'll do some more mailbag coming up next here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. So let's jump right back into the mailbag. The next comes from me and Lou with the Twitter handle me and Lou. Buckaroo. Sorry, I had to read that. I had to read that really slowly because it's throwing me. Me and Lou Buckaroo asks, does Nick Castellanos have a bounce back season or are we stuck with a light hitting outfielder DH for the next 4 years? Isn't that the question of the offseason? Outside of who they're going to bring in, what in the heck happened to Nick Castellanos this year? I know Dave Dombrowski was asked about it in the news conference. Unbelievably, he said there was really no injury that Castellanos was playing through. I find that incredibly hard to believe given the fact the guy could not hit a fly ball to the warning track in the entire postseason. Like he literally did not hit a fly ball to the warning track during the course of the entire postseason. So I don't know with Nick Castellanos whether it was just he got off to a red hot start. He looked like himself. I was watching some highlights of him in the first month and a half, and he's those pitches on the outer part of the half, he's like driving them to the right center field gap and over the fence and stuff. Like he was pounding the ball when it was in the zone. After he got hit by the wrist against the Mets, his production dropped immediately. Then it picked up again in August, and then he had the oblique injury. They rushed him back for the playoffs, and I think maybe he just never recovered from the oblique in the postseason but tried to kind of give you whatever he had. I don't know what we're going to get from Nick Castellanos. I think the odds are better than not that he's better, but I don't know if we get the great Nick Castellanos back again. Liz, as an answer to this question, are we stuck with a light hitting outfielder DH for the next 4 years?
Good God, I hope not. That would be tragic.
Yeah.
I can only say I hope not. I mean, that's my feeling. It's not like Castellanos has this strong history. I don't think the player we saw this year for the whole time is the player he is permanently. At least we can all hope. I wish I could answer this question for sure. We all do. But My hope and assumption is that that's not who he is and that the first year in Philly was maybe harder than he thought it was going to be. Maybe the lack of spring training, it seemed to really throw some guys off until a certain point in the season. We don't have a light hitting, whatever. We didn't waste all that money, because if we did, that's depressing.
Maybe, Justin, it was the fact, and everybody talked about the fact that he had a new baby in May, and May is when the production dropped off the cliff. But for me, I'm not sold on the idea that it was a new city. He wasn't ready, because he came out like gangbusters in the first 5 weeks of the season. And it was mystifying that it went away. If it wasn't an injury to the wrist that slowed him down, then there really just isn't any other explanation for it other than he wasn't getting any sleep with the new baby at home, which Major League Baseball players have had babies in the season before. This isn't the first time this ever happened. So it's weird.
I think in general, you could piece together a theory of some kind. I was pretty staggered when I heard you mention his early season stats on Hittin' Season, maybe like 2 weeks ago, when you talked about how well he was doing before he got hit on the thumb. That probably has something to do with it. Baby has something to do with it. New city has something to do with it. You know, maybe to all of these things. At the end of the day, you're most of the time not going to, unless the reason is like really clear, you're not going to get a full reason. You're not going to get a full mental report on what was going through a guy's head as he suffered through a weirdly poor season. I don't think he's the first player to undergo something like this. That being said, Castellanos specifically, you're never going to find out what's really going on inside his head. So I'm just assuming there were adjustments that needed to be made that he wasn't making, that he maybe did get dinged a little harder on his wrist than he wants to talk about publicly for whatever reason. And it was hurting him when he was trying to hit those pitches he loves, those low and outside pitches he's got to duck halfway to the ground for and swing the bat like he's returning a tennis serve. That for some reason when he's healthy, he can inexplicably hit with like so much power. I don't think we're ever really going to know the reason. I think that you are going to see a better Nick Castellanos next year. Cause then you look at 2021, that was his best season ever.
Yeah.
And then he came here and he had like his worst season. And I know a lot of people like to talk about how often that happens, but that'll probably get lost in the same way that the Mets collapse got lost because they made the playoffs. Another Phillies player coming here and being bad is going to get lost because the Phillies went to the World Series. And I don't think that's indicative of who he's going to be in the long term. I just think there was some X factor or a collection of medium-sized X factors that just contributed to his overall poor mental approach at the plate. Maybe pitchers just knew how to adjust to him better. Who knows? Maybe the book on him suddenly came out and went around the league. But at the end of the day, I do think you're going to see he's a professional hitter. They have one of the best hitting coaches in baseball in-house. And he's got plenty of resources and his own track record to fall back on. So like you guys are saying, the Phillies didn't pay for a light hitting outfielder DH when they paid for Nick Castellanos. So they're going to do whatever they can on their end, whatever he allows to figure out what happened and correct it. Because Nick Castellanos is here to do what he said at the beginning of the season, hit home runs, make money. Yeah. So I think you're going to see more of that in 2023.
It's just it was huge in the playoffs that they didn't have a number five hitter to hit behind Bryce Harper. I mean, how many times especially in the World Series, the Astros figured out, hey, maybe let's not pitch to Bryce Harper and we'll see if Nick Castellanos can beat us. And he couldn't. Viceroy Alec Costoval at Costoval on Base tweeted, should the Phillies consider taking a reliever in the Rule 5 draft? I think the easy answer to this question is if there's because it's going to be like a single A guy, right? That's what teams, they typically leave like a single A guy. Or a double A guy with, you know, maybe who might be really low on their prospect list. If they find somebody who's like a single A guy who they feel is worth trying to roster, I think you at least would draft him. The Phillies have a World Series contending roster. So it's not like back in 2017 and 2018 when you can stick Peter Borjas on your roster. I don't even know how to pronounce his name anymore. That's how long it's been.
Peter Borges,
whatever, who cares? But Michael Martinez stuck around for all of 2011 for some reason as a Rule 5 pick. So I think if there's a reliever with really good stuff out there, and let's say the Rays leave somebody on, you know, exposed, or the, you know, whoever it might be, I would at least draft him. And then if you end up not keeping him, you send him back. But I think there's enough jobs open on this bullpen, and the Phillies are looking for enough high octane arms that they should consider drafting a reliever in the Rule 5. Justin, that's where I would lean, and just draft him. And if you don't keep him, send him back.
What does it cost you to draft somebody in the Rule 5 again? What's the price tag?
$500,000 maybe.
Yeah, I mean,
he's
I get
be
a little
on your big league roster, so I don't know.
With the you mentioned the Rays specifically, it's always kind of funny. Like, okay, this guy's coming from the Rays pitching academy, so maybe he's got this secret. But then again, if the Rays are letting him go, then perhaps that ship has sailed. But yeah, in general, yeah, this team could even if this team was had a lights out bullpen, I'm still going to look at that Rule 5 and think, anybody out there whose name I recognize from scouting them or liking them or hearing about them from somebody else who's just available for this small price tag? Yeah, you got to load up that bullpen with as many promising arms as you can, as young or low in the system as they might be. You still need to fill that junk drawer with people who are talented contributors, who you're going to be able to reach for if things get dicey, even if they aren't somebody at the top of the list as far as making the major league roster out of spring training. So yeah, no, I'd be all on board for that, because you know, at the end of the day, what are you giving up to just see what a guy can do? And like you said, if it doesn't work, just give him back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have nothing more to add. Justin said it all.
I mean, you didn't have to bring Michael Martinez into it, but everything else.
I was just going to say, it's just so much.
All right, next question. This comes from our good pals at the Fransky in LA Twitter feed, at Fransky LA, asking, who gets the Adam Eaton treatment at the ring ceremony next April? And this kind of goes along with a tweeted question from Dan at DWolfRVA, who asked, who's the player that you forgot was on the Phillies roster this year? I think those two questions kind of go hand in hand. Like at the ring ceremony next year, is there going to be somebody like with the 2008 Phillies and Adam Eaton? You're like, holy crap, that guy actually played for the 2008 Phillies and made like a ton of starts. He started like 20 games for the 2008 Phillies until they got Joe Blanton, which was just kind of nuts. So as we're thinking about the 2022 Phillies, this roster, we got to remember there were some weird names at the beginning of the season. Anybody have a name they want to jump off with to start things off here?
The answer is Mickey Moniak.
Oh God!
What are we talking about, though?
Do you remember how excited we were when he came out of spring training? Oh my gosh!
Being forgotten is one thing. Adam Eaton treatment is getting booed at the World Series rings. Everybody,
yeah, that's right. I think that's what he means.
I don't know if anybody on this team was despised enough, which is kind of interesting considering we were just talking about Nick Castellanos. And I don't know if people really ran out of people ran out of patience with him, but at no point did he get booed. I assume because people every at bat was like, maybe this is the one where he turns it around. Maybe this time. And then in the postseason,
he had
three amazing catches that saved at least two games on their own. So I don't think anybody was complaining about it.
There's a guy.
Reese got booed at a postseason game I was at. Then he came back, hit an incredible home run, and spiked the bat to the core of the earth. And then he wasn't getting booed anymore. But I definitely heard him getting booed at some point during the World Series. But yeah, no, I said Mickey Moniak because I think he was at a World Series game, and someone pointed out he gets a ring if they win. Mm-hmm. And so as far as like the forgotten question goes, I was like, yeah, that's probably one. But then you know, a guy like, was it Chris Davinsky ran out on the field at player introductions? And I was like, who the hell is that? So
that's right. I think there's absolutely a couple of guys who would get booed. Our old pal Odubel Herrera, when he comes back. Ah,
yes.
I think he'd get booed.
Yes. Yes.
I think he'd get booed. I think you'd also see Jurys Familia.
Yes.
Get his rear end booed off. If he came.
I totally forgot that they would be involved in that and they would both be booed. Absolutely.
Yep. It's a good thing we've all forgotten.
What about Didi Gregorius?
They wouldn't boo him.
No, I don't think they would boo him either. Fun. Yeah. I'm going down the list here. There's some.
Does anyone know who Michael Plassmeyer is? I have legitimately never heard of him.
He was a reliever they picked. He was like AAA. They traded for him or acquired him somehow in the middle of the season, and I think everyone was like, oh yeah, he can contribute in the bullpen. He never really, not in a huge way, or
two games pitch total 7.1 innings, so it was definitely long relief.
Yeah, he must have soaked up a doubleheader batch of innings or some. Tyler Sir is another one. Bobby Rossman got an inning in the final game.
That's not real.
These are made up names.
Nick Duron got an inning at the end of the season.
Now that one I remember.
Yeah.
I only remember him because his name is very Italian.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
There are plenty of forgettable names, and I don't mean that in an insulting way. It's just like, yeah, you just, you know, pitched one or two innings, then you're probably going to get forgotten. Yep. But yeah, I do think getting booed is, that's totally different. No one's going to boo a long reliever who soaked up a doubleheader because...
No.
Like, come on.
there's some fun names in there that I just, you wouldn't think. And I don't know, like, is Michael Plassmeyer getting a ring? I don't think he is getting it. I don't know what the rule is.
What is the threshold for getting a ring?
It can't be that, right? You know, it can't be like, hey, we called you up for game 162 because everybody's hungover. You get a ring. That can't be it.
I feel like we look this up every year because it's always a question. It just never was a question for the Phillies in the time that we've done this podcast.
We'll have to check into that a little bit more and do a little bit more homework on that one. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll finish up the podcast with a few questions. We'll go a little lightning roundish on them to get them all in. Still some more questions coming your way here on Hittin' Season. So stick around. We'll be right back. And we're back on Hittin' Season. So Behind the Plate, at Behind the Plate 4, asked us, should the Phillies sign Cody Bellinger to play right field while Bryce Harper is on the injured list? He says, I bet Kevin Long can fix him. I think it's interesting. We had one Twitter person asking if we should blame the World Series loss on Kevin Long, and another one asking if we should sign Cody Bellinger because he can fix Cody Bellinger. And I wouldn't put anything past Kevin Long, but I think Cody Bellinger is going to get a one-year deal, probably about $15 million someplace. Liz, are you bringing Cody Bellinger to this team, a former MVP guy who forgot how to hit over the last few seasons on a one-year $15 million deal, young guy?
No. I mean, they've got so much money they want to spend other places. Like, why spend it on a one-year for a guy that you have no idea whether or not he's going to, it's not the Nick Castellanos situation. We've already signed a guy who was bad.
Yeah.
Who was bad. Let's not sign someone who's been actively bad and sign him for a year. And, we could make it better, but then he could leave. So it's an interesting idea and I appreciate the creativity definitely, but I don't think it's a realistic idea, nor do I think it should happen.
This is a Ruben Amaro era fantasy. I feel where we went to the World Series. So now we're just like, well, let's just get the most expensive part-time outfielder we possibly could. I mean, you could play center. You could play a little center too, if you want that. But I don't know if that's a place where the Phillies are going to spend a ton of money because, a guy's usefulness in that role doesn't have to be Bellinger. It doesn't have to be all the stuff attached with him. Like, well, he's going to figure it out. He was good before and you just give him a chance. Blah, blah, blah. That's complicating things, I feel.
Well, and the other factor here is, would Cody Bellinger come play here? The answer is no, because as soon as Bryce Harper's ready to come back, he doesn't have a starting job. He wants to sign a one-year prove-it deal someplace. He's more likely to go sign with Colorado Rockies than he would be to come back to Philadelphia so that he can get his numbers up on a one-year deal and hit a free agent contract next season. So he's not coming here because he wants that one last shot at a ring and he's willing to be a fourth guy once Bryce Harper comes back. It's got to be a good deal, a good situation for the free agent as well as for the team. So there's no way, this is not an appealing place for Cody Bellinger because he's not going to take Castellanos' job, Schwarber's job. And frankly, center field is Brandon Marsh's job. They've invested in Brandon Marsh. He's not going anywhere. I mean, you might see Vierling platoon with him a little bit against some tough lefties, but they got to see if Brandon Marsh can actually play. So there's just no room for him on this team unless they're going to send somebody out. And I don't think that makes you better if you're doing that.
I don't know. I mean, I know we just said Dave Dombrowski is a liar and don't believe him, but at the same time, he did say like they look at Brandon Marsh as their center fielder of the future as well. So that's how I've been looking at him. They suddenly decided Cody Bellinger was the guy, it would be pretty jarring.
Yep, for sure. Aaron Mock at Aaron Mock 5 asked, how do you feel about Aaron Nola getting fourth in the Cy Young voting in light of the fact in 31% of his starts this year, his ERA was 8.42. Almost a third of his starts were really bad. Please don't tell me he had bad luck. Aaron Nola finishing fourth in the NL Cy Young.
How does this person feel about it, I wonder?
This is a question coming from a place. There's no doubt about it. Listen, Aaron Nola had, we know what he is. He's an ace in two-thirds of his starts, where he looks like one of the best starting pitchers in baseball. And then he does have a third of his starts where he's given up 4, 5, 6 runs. And that's kind of who he is. It's kind of what we saw in the playoffs. He's really, really good. And I think he deserved it more than the other guys below him in the Cy Young voting, Justin. I don't think that it was necessarily a matter of he won it on reputation. He got that far by reputation. He's really good. The inconsistency does drive you crazy, but there's also a lot of Aaron Nola slander going on that is, I think, highly unhelpful. And I guarantee you there's a million other teams that would trade places with the Phillies and would love to have him on the deal that they have him right now.
I think Aaron Nola is the Reese Hoskins of pitchers.
For sure.
He's just capable of so much, and then suddenly he's just not. And it's always at the worst moments, it feels like. And until this season, he really had a reputation for coming up small, and that was he earned that. He earned that in a couple of seasons. I know we wanted to. There was some arguments that the September collapse thing for him was overplayed, and I think the argument was because it hasn't been every September of his career, and that's true. But it was, I think, the two previous to this one, and it's like that's 2 years in a row. That's enough to build a narrative. That's enough to draw some conclusions about a guy. I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I think there are starts where he looks like one of the best pitchers in baseball. He is a guy like any team would take and put at the top of their rotation. But he's also part of the reason why we're talking about the Phillies needing another guy, because I feel like I can't rely on him. I still feel like, which is crazy, because I feel like I've gone all the way around. Like I said, I needed the first half of the season to trust him again, and I did, because he was great for the first half of the season, and then continued to be a huge asset for the Phillies. And then those last three games of the postseason, you know, sucked. So I'm not putting it on. I'm not going to take the bait here and say that it was bad luck. It wasn't. Aaron Nola gets bashed sometimes. He puts the ball where he's not supposed to. He allows the other team to make contact, a lot of contact right in a row, a lot of fast, abrupt lead changes when Aaron Nola doesn't have his best stuff. I don't know if there's an answer. I don't know if that was even what the question was. The question was, how do you feel about him being fourth? I wouldn't have been, if the Phillies, like, if we hadn't just undergone that October, I don't think I would have been as like, oh, right. Because I kind of just forgot after his last three disappointing starts in the postseason that, oh, right, he had that, like, great year behind all of that. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had to go back and remember that. So it was a little jarring to see him up there. But, you know, yeah, I'm with you. I think he deserved it. I think he was, it's crazy. It's some of the frustrating starts you've seen him make to consider him a top five pitcher. But then I looked at the other names and the other numbers, and I don't think it's crazy that he's there. I just think that back when people were frustrated with Hector Neris a lot of the time as a closer, and then other, you know, his supporters would point at his numbers and you'd be like, yeah, why are we so mad? And the answer was because all the runs and games he cost the Phillies were always against the Dodgers, Giants, or Braves. And those were like extra frustrating losses. So I think you have that kind of aspect with Nola as well, not because of specific teams he loses against. I mean, maybe it is. I'm not looking at the numbers, but less so because of specific teams and more so because of specific types of games where he just doesn't have it. The ones where you sit down with a beer and you're like, boy, it's a Nola start. Like, really use a win today. And then it's just like 5-0 in the second inning. And you're like, and so you're mad. Yeah. And the last three games he started were in the postseason and the World Series. So, you know, he didn't look great in those games, and it makes you mad. Makes you madder than you would be in a game in May. So I think there's a lot of emotion tied up in this. I think a lot of people have drawn conclusions about Nola the past few years, and that reputation is going to be hard for him to break for some people, in the same way that Reese Hoskins has. Like, some people are just always going to think about him the same way, no matter what he does. And that's just kind of how it is. So I do. I think there's just a lot of frustration with Hoskins and a lot of frustration with Nola. And nobody's ever going to believe that where they actually are is somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, Liz, it strikes me as, like, I think the reason he's so frustrating is it's kind of like a Lucy in the football kind of thing, where you get suckered into, and not suckered in, that's not the word I want to use for this, but you see how dominant he is and can be when he's got his command and his stuff and he's locating. And it's the same thing with Reese Hoskins when he gets really hot and he's hitting all those home runs and he's carrying you for weeks at a time. And you can't expect a guy to carry you the whole season, But you also don't expect for those highs to be followed by crashes, like a volatile stock market. And I think that's the issue with Rhys Hoskins and with Aaron Nola specifically, is like he can spin like a month and a half worth of games where he's a top five pitcher in baseball. I mean, there's just he gets hittable for two, three, four starts in a row. And sometimes it comes at the worst time. And I think people start to get sucked into like, okay, Aaron Nola's great. Here's the ace, Aaron Nola. And then, whoa, what just happened? He just gave up seven runs. What's going on here?
Why can't he be great all the time?
Why can't he be great all the time?
Exactly. That's just not who he is. Like, we're not saying he's unlucky anymore. I don't think we've said that. I think we have said it, but not definitively about the Aaron Nola experience for a little while now. This is who he is. You know, it's not unlucky. Sometimes it is, but this is just the pitcher he is. You know, if you go through any pitcher, even the best, and you pick out, you know, their five or six worst starts, the ERA for those starts is going to be pretty bad. I feel like
That's right.
This is not a great way to evaluate a pitcher. Let's just pick out his worst starts and give you the ERA for them and say, this is what he does when he's bad. Boo, boo this man. But unfortunately, that's just not. That's not how it works. I really think that's not a great way to evaluate a pitcher. I appreciate your question for us, guy who sent that question, but that's just not enough for me. To be like, no, Aaron Nola is bad and garbage. Like every pitcher's going to be bad. Go back to Justin Verlander's start this year. Pick out his however many worst starts. I'm sure the number's better than an ERA of 8, but every pitcher has bad starts. And when you put them all together, every pitcher's bad.
Yeah. No, not everybody can be great all the time. And sometimes you get a season where a guy is great every time out, but it's I get the Aaron Nola frustration. I also think just acceptance is key here. And if you want to go out and get another ace, if you want to get Justin Verlander because you don't trust Aaron Nola, you could do that. And so also remember, Justin Verlander was not very good in the World Series this year either. So just kind of how it goes sometimes. All right, let's do some rapid fire here. We only got a little bit of time left. There's a lot of questions. If we don't get them all in here, folks, we'll do another mailbag episode, either on the Good Fight. I'll write something up or, we'll do something for the Patreon. But, Charles Wolf at Charles W. Wolf asks, with Kevin Long locked up, which member of the daycare do you think improves the most offensively next year? Liz, who do you think?
I completely missed what you said. Could you tell me again?
Sure. With Kevin Long locked up, which member of the daycare do you think improves the most offensively next year?
The lightning round is going really well.
I know. I'm sorry. I missed the word daycare, and I'm like, what am I supposed to say?
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so sorry. Doing this midday doesn't always help either. Who's going to be good next year, be good, break out? I think Bryson Stott. I love him.
That's my answer.
Do we consider Alec Bohm always? Alec Bohm is broken out now. He is broken out. We can't have him as a breakout candidate. Does that seem fair?
I don't know. He was the number six hitter, and I don't know. Yeah, I guess you could say if by breakout you means Alec Bohm puts up all-star numbers, I think yes, you could say Alec Bohm breakout in 2022 for sure. If that's how we're defining it, yes.
Yes,
so
true.
I don't know that I see that coming. I believe Bryson Stott can become a 270, 280 hitter for a full season
completely
next year. And that to me would be a breakout guy at shortstop. Justin, what do you think?
I mean, that's kind of a positive thing that there aren't a ton of names to pick from here because a lot of these guys have kind of turned around. Like you're saying, obviously Alec Bohm could put together an all-star season, but everyone was so satisfied by his evolution this year on both sides of the ball. So I feel like, he knows he's reached a level where he is he's not in the basement where he started because of Kevin Long. So, I mean, and Brandon Marsh kind of did the same thing. He got here and started hitting 300 because of something Kevin Long said to him and some adjustments he had to make. So, I'll just stick with Marsh because I want to see him do well. And, at 24 years old, and we just called him the center fielder of the future. I think breaking out for Marsh looks like hitting around 300 and cutting down on the strikeouts. And I don't know if that's, he's going to, I don't know if he'll ever really cut down fully on the strikeouts. It is kind of just part of his game, but I feel like with a full winter with the Phillies hitting staff and the adjustments he's learned to make, and you know, now he's fully embedded in the Phillies franchise and considered a part of their future. I think it'd be a great place to see another guy break out. Be great to have a center fielder who's closer to a number one hitter rather than a number nine hitter. But you know, that's a kind of a big leap to make in one winter.
Yeah, I think we saw a lot of improvement from Brandon Marsh after coming to the Phillies. The numbers, if you look at him from his time in Anaheim to Philadelphia, big change, big drop in strikeouts, much more contact, and he hit about 280 after coming to Philadelphia. So, and he, you know, listen, I get it. And this next question kind of also dovetails on that last one. Number one Hurts fan at Anthony 6095-7284 asks, any chance you think they could try to upgrade center field this offseason? I will see that Marsh at bat in game 5 in my nightmares for the rest of my life. And I get that. I still think that was the turning point of the World Series when Marsh was not able to put the ball in play with first and third and one out in the bottom of the eighth down by one. That being said, he was actually one of the few hitters in the World Series, I think, to hit over 200. I think he hit like 260 or 270 in the World Series. So he actually hit pretty well in the Fall Classic. But, you know, he's your number nine hitter. You weren't expecting a whole lot from him offensively. An upgrade, I think he's their center fielder of the future. They traded Logan Ohapi for him because they felt like he could be there. He's 24. Like, he felt like he can be their guy for the next 5, 6, 7 years. So I don't see them upgrading with like Brandon Nimmo or something like that. Do you?
No. I mean, there are times when yes, Dave Dombrowski is always lying, but I don't see a way that he could have been lying about Brandon Marsh. We see him as our center fielder of the future. I don't think that's something you just sort of throw out there for funsies because, you know, you need words to say at a press conference. You know, if he says that he's our center fielder of the future, that seems like a pretty safe bet. Why would they upgrade at center field when they have a guy there who they can work with, who they can help continue to improve? Why are they going to spend a lot of money that could be spent elsewhere on something they have already or could, you know, make themselves?
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, I think this is a case of somebody who was emotionally devastated by something a player did or didn't do in this case. And that's going to be their lasting memory of them for a long time. But this is just another area where you're like, okay, so what's the plan here to upgrade at center field? The Phillies did upgrade at center field. It wasn't hard to upgrade at center field. They were getting nothing from the position, and now they have a guy there from whom they got a great half of the season, especially compared to his numbers in the first half of the season with his other team. As John said, like every one of his numbers ballooned by 60, 70 points when he came to Philadelphia. I mean, that's not nothing. And if that's the way he's, you know, maybe he's even trending, and that's not even like the full improvement he's going to make, like I was saying before. And again, what's the alternative? Like you said, Brandon Nimmo's at the top of the center fielder free agent class. Brandon Nimmo. I mean, he's not like a bad player, but you know, is that as necessary a change that the Phillies would have to make it? Because after that, it's like Kevin Kiermaier and the same names we were talking about last year. So like, No, these are not improvements. And then so like, what, you want to orchestrate a trade for a position where you don't really have a desperate need and you certainly have other needs elsewhere and you've already kind of embedded this guy in your organization? So I don't, everybody had a frustrating at bat in the World Series. This team hit 163 in the World Series. There's nobody who's getting off scot-free for their at bats in the World Series. So I think we all have the players who are going to haunt our memories all winter long and the moments that could have been something else. But at the end of the day, this team got to the World Series and needed to win 3 more games and 2 more games, 2 more games.
2 more games.
Yeah, and they would have won the World Series. So this was a better team than anybody thought, and a lot of that was because the players came together and a couple of them really performed better than they had before, and Brandon Marsh was one of those guys. So I'm not of the mind that they need to go out and improve at center field.
All right. Well, I would like to get to some more questions here, but we'll save some. I'll write some of these up for a Good Fight article. I will just do one more quick one here. Brian Coulter at Phila B. Coulter asks a fun one. Which random Phillies player from this pennant winner will be in the Phillies broadcast booth in the fictitious year of 2045? a la Larry Anderson, of course, with Scott Fransky. Who are we thinking from this group will be the next Philadelphia's Phillies media star further down the road? Does anybody have one?
Kyle Schwarber. He knows how to captivate an audience. He knows how to, he can get all eyes on me. He can lead a room. He can lead a discussion. I can see him sitting there having a nice time with salt and pepper hair. And just talking about, you know, with a story to reach for. I mean, he's already been in the World Series a couple of times. He's played for a couple of upstart teams. He's made some history in baseball and he can.
That's perfect.
He's got everything you want in a color commentator.
I will take Garrett Stubbs, who seemed to be like that wacky guy that everybody, I mean, he was really productive this year as a backup catcher. He was very good. Yeah, exactly. He was very, very good. I think he seemed to be that energy guy that everybody kind of rallied around and was always the guy looking to go get more beer for everybody in the celebrations and all that stuff. And so he's backup catchers typically do a pretty good job once they get into the broadcast booth. You know, I think Eric Coase did some, Eric Kratz did some. Did I say Eric Coase? I meant Chris Coase. If I said Eric,
you whatever. Did. We all okay. know what you meant.
Yeah, okay. Chris Coase, Eric Kratz, whatever. Those guys have all had good secondary careers in the broadcast booth. I'm going Garrett Stubbs. I think he's here in 2045.
Yeah, you know what? Schwarber like winds up on MLB Network postseason coverage.
Yeah, Garrett with Stubbs Big Poppy and all them. Yeah,
on the radio broadcast for the Phillies.
Jimmy-esque.
Yeah, exactly.
Mine is Matt Vierling. He's just like the perfect kind of background role player. It's a name like Kevin Franzen. It's a position player like Kevin Franzen. You know, it's a guy that the name you're always going to remember. You're like, he had that one big hit one time, or he did that awesome thing, you know, one or two times. And that great year the Phillies had, everyone will remember him. I think, you know, I don't know what his voice sounds like. I don't remember if I've ever heard him speak or even if he can. I'm assuming he can. Mm-hmm. But that definitely has some bearing on this. But if we're looking for a guy to fit a profile, Matt Vierling is it.
He's already pretty media savvy. He's got those commercials out, right? What was that commercial that he was doing?
Safe Flight?
Yeah, Safe Flight or something like that. I forget exactly what it was. But yeah, he's not wasting any time. I think he understands he's got the face for it.
You gotta make your mark now.
Exactly. All right, let's wrap this episode of the podcast up here. Let's get to our final thoughts. Does anyone want to go first with final thoughts? Every time I ask someone final thoughts first, somebody else has something else they want to say or wants to wait. So who wants to go first?
I could go first. It's mostly just
go ahead, Liz.
Happy Thanksgiving to one and all. I have no other more complicated final thoughts. Enjoy your Thanksgiving. Enjoy the food. Enjoy the people. Enjoy the football.
Now, Justin, after the last time, your last final thought brought some people to tears, as I was seeing online.
It was great.
It was phenomenal. So now I don't know what you've got planned, but we all wait in gleeful anticipation.
you always have to add something.
It's all about taking advantage of people's emotional state and manipulating them into thinking you're great. And,
for sure.
I nailed that. So now... no, this was more about solving a mystery, and I was reading, you know, obviously everyone at this point, I assume, is familiar with my interest in quirky center fielders, and Brandon Marsh does fill that role to an extent, so obviously you've heard me talk about him on this episode alone in a positive way. And I was reading an article on Fangraphs about that. It was like four duds who could be studs in 2023. And they listed Brandon Marsh. And in the write-up, it literally says, "Hi, Justin," in parentheses. And it really geeked me out in that the internet was talking back to me. But in the time since I told you guys about this during the commercial break, I believe I've solved it. I believe he was referring to another Fangraphs writer named Justin Mason, who in a recent chat, it seems to hint that he is also in on Brandon Marsh in Philadelphia, because he's actually asked the question, where is Bellinger going to sign? And he said, difficult to figure out, but I think he'll have a plethora of options considering his upside in defense. What is a team with money that needs a center fielder? And then he said, Philadelphia. so he can kill my Marsh shares. But he's also kind of saying that Philadelphia is a team with money that needs a center fielder, and I just disagree with that. I think they have their center fielder. I don't think this is an area we need to get into this offseason.
I'll just say it would have been an incredible waste of Logan Ohapi as a trade chip if they're going to turn it, especially after he improved. It's not like he came to Philadelphia and hit at 185. You know, he did better. So, yeah, and he had some big hits in the postseason too. So it's not like again, that game five at bat was awful, but all that aside, you know, he did well. So very interesting. Lots of interesting questions.
They can't change now. Not that Justin has gotten Brandon Marsh's name tattooed across his back with like a giant eagle and the Fanatic like shooting out of the eagle's body, revealing itself to be the true official bird of America.
Well, the tattoo is going to be on my neck so that his beard is my chest hair.
That makes me uncomfortable.
That's terrifying. God, Justin.
I don't care for that at all. All right.
Once
well, look,
again,
folks,
leaving us speechless.
People are crying for a different reason. That's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season, everybody. Thanks, everybody, for the questions. And we're with Thanksgiving almost here. We really are thankful for all of you guys to keep joining us every week and to submit questions to us and to keep track of our predictions at the start of the year and let us know who wins these things. I mean, we forget about them, so it's amazing to us that you guys are paying attention. So thank you for continuing to come. If you're new to this podcast, thank you for coming along for the postseason ride, and we hope you'll stay with us throughout the rest of the offseason. We're going to take a little midweek break with Thanksgiving coming, but we'll be back with some more podcasts coming your way over the weekend, maybe at the beginning of next week and throughout the offseason as we see what Dave Dombrowski and the Phillies are going to do. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. We'll talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.